Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you to the book show, All Sides Weekend Books, where we're going to spend the next hour talking about quick picks, new sellers, and old friends with three dear friends. They are Chris Hickey, who is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. Chris comes to the show with the library's latest quick picks, which she will explain to us presently. Nick White is on the faculty of the Department of English and Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. He is an acclaimed author with several titles to his credit and probably more than one movie deal, knowing Nick. Nick White is back with us. And Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and her blog, which is indispensable for anyone who loves to read, is thelongestchapter.com. Welcome. Happy New Year, our first show of the new year. We are all masked and shut up and everything else and distanced, and we're sitting here ready to talk about books. And Nick White, because you've been away for the holidays and you're back with us, I want you to go first because you have several large books and you have a Claire Keenan book there.
Oh my God, I want to start off by talking about this one. Well, first of all, I want to preface this by saying I first became aware of this book because of the great and good Cassie Rose.
Me too.
Who talked about this book the last time I was on, I think. Mm-hmm. And I read it over the holidays, and it was the book I needed at the right time. It takes place over Christmas holidays, this book, Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan, a small novella, I think mm-hmm. we would call this. Takes place in Ireland. Main character, Bill Furlong is his name. Yes. He works at a coal mine. He has a family. We learn that his mother was unwed when she had him, and he never really knew who his father was. And this is important because when he is delivering coal to this Catholic church, this laundromat run by nuns, he witnesses something there that disturbs him. And I won't get it away, but it sort of picks at him, and he has to make a decision to do the good, right thing. And he knows when he does this that everyone is going to be against him when he does this, when he makes this decision, but he can't not do it. And this was like such a beautiful book that I read this year, because if you're listening to this radio show, I have no doubt that you've probably experienced some loss in your life because of like the current moment that we're living in. And this was such a bright light of a book that just like hit me at the right time. And it was one of the best reading experiences I've had in probably the past 10 years. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. You can read it in one setting. It is a beautiful, beautiful testament to ordinary goodness, which I feel like a lot of writers are fearful of writing about, because I feel like we live in such a cynical age, and we want to be... We sort of run away from these like emotions that because we don't want to sound melodramatic or sentimental. But the way Claire Keegan represents it in this book, I think it's just honest and ordinary and good. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
I read it in one sitting myself. I should make the point, I believe it's set a number of years ago. It's not
1985.
It's 1985. When the so-called laundries in Ireland were still prevalent and a source of great abuse. And I'll leave that alone there. But to Cassie, you were very enthusiastic about this book, which I uh-huh. think led it to become a quick pick. We'll get that bit later.
Yes, so. There is something about this book, and Nick, what you've said about that ordinary goodness. And I remember talking about it on the show because I was getting choked up, and I could feel myself very close to the edge of honestly just, I don't know. When I was reading the book at home and when it ended, I mean, I started to cry out of a good feeling because of this man, because of what he does, and because that feeling that Claire Keegan writes so well about how you do the right thing, and you know that at some point when it comes out that the world is going to be against you, your community is, you're going to get a lot of people pushing back at you. And the way that she describes that feeling, that knowledge within him, feels so real that anyone, I think, can relate to it.
And I took from the title small things like these that it's in a way a small thing to do the right thing. But it becomes a big thing when other people react against it there. It's a long short story or a very short novel. You could read it a couple of times if you want to get weepy. And I will say it's not so much anti-anything, but it's about a positive man doing a positive thing, a simple man.
Ordinary goodness.
Ordinary goodness.
I'm going to be teaching this book to my students.
Are you
really?
Because
I think the craft of the book is so meticulous. Claire Keegan, such a fine writer. I did not realize this till after I finished the book, but she's author of a short story collection called Foster,
which is on my bedside table.
And
right now.
I've read the title story. It was in Best American a few years ago, and it is again. Deals with similar subject matter of this idea of ordinary goodness, and it's such a beautifully restrained story. And Claire Keegan is one of those writers that she gives you just enough. So anyway, please, if you're listening to this and you want a good read that won't take too much of your time but will definitely reverberate in your life, please check out this book, Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These, which is a quick pick at the library.
It is a quick pick.
Speaking of quick picks, Chris Hickey is here from the Columbus Library, and she brings us the quick picks every time she joins us from the Whetstone branch. But the quick picks are good industry, I mean, all through every branch.
Yes.
So what do you have for us? First of all, review what a quick pick is. And then maybe start your recommendation.
Okay, so a quick pick. These are the books that have long hold lists. They might be on the bestseller. They're just very popular. And so what we do is we have books that are not coded so that they go out on reserve for people. So the idea is these books are sitting on the shelf waiting for you to come into one of our buildings. And then you can check it out. You can jump the line. You might be number 537, but you can check it out that day because you found it in the library.
And Small Things Like These is a quick pick.
Yes, and I'm the only person in this room who hasn't read it, but I am going to remedy that very quickly. So if it's on the shelf, you might want to beat me to it, because when I get back to the branch, I'm going to look for it, and I'm going to snag it and read it on my lunch break.
Whetstone's, one of you folks on Whetstone right now listening to this show,
yes,
grab
go
it and
get
put it away from Chris
beat
Hickey.
Beat me there.
Yes.
When I get back, I'm looking for it.
Okay, what do you have for us?
So I have the new Colleen Hoover. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with Colleen Hoover. So she has a massive following. Colleen Hoover is the number three most followed author on Goodreads, only behind Stephen King and Bill Gates.
Lord, so I
went down a bit of a rabbit hole with her. I first heard of her. People were starting to ask for her books, and I discovered that all of her books were out, like even older books. She has three books that are currently on the New York Times bestseller.
Lord, the only Hoover I knew before this was the vacuum.
Right. No, Colleen Hoover's big. And TikTok. It is TikTok. She has a
Book-talk,
rabid
yes.
following of readers that are, you know, ages 18 to 26 is kind of her core demographic. And this demographic is referred to as the new adult. So people who've just stepped out of the teen years, and they are mad for her. So she writes really compelling. They're a little bit romance. There's some mystery. Some of them have a thriller feel to them. But I started reading it, and she's a compelling storyteller. So this one is called Reminders of Him, and it's about a young woman named Kenna who just got out of serving 5 years in prison. And she goes back to this small town where whatever happened happened. And whatever happened resulted in the death of this man that she loved. And she had a daughter while in prison. So one of the reasons that she's returned to this small town is she's hoping to connect with this child that's now 4 years old, because she hasn't had any contact with her. This child's being raised by the parents of the man who died. And so it's told in some different points of view. It's her point of view and then the point of view of a man named Ledger. And he's a bartender. And the night where she comes back to town and, you know, moves into her small apartment with an air mattress, she goes to this bar so that she can write in her journal. And he just feels this connection to her and her to him, because, you know, he's never seen her before. She's, I'm assuming, very beautiful from what they're describing, and very sad. So she's, you know, writing in this journal. She's writing letters to Scott, who is the man who died, because she loved him deeply. And whatever happened was tragic and awful. And so we come to find out that Ledger has a connection to her daughter. And so she wants to connect with this daughter, but I think the family's going to try not to let that happen. So I'm just kind of at the beginning of this book as we're getting to know these two characters. And it is compelling.
Is it the
so
plot?
I get it.
Is it the way she's writing? Is
it's
the
both.
Way, is it the way the characters are trying to get to know each other or figure each other out?
I think it's all of those
that?
Things. Huh. And what I thought was interesting when I went down my TikTok Colleen Hoover rabbit hole, like these people, they buy her books in paperback and they fill it with tabs. So they annotate these books when they read them. I mean, it's just so exciting. And they take videos of themselves crying as they're reading this book.
Oh, this warms the cockles of my heart.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful?
They need to come to Ohio State and take creative writing classes, please.
Asking your students are the demographic. Ask them, have you heard of Colleen Hoover? And just see what the reaction is.
I will do this.
Because I can't wait to hear what they say.
So is it just because I'm old that I don't know who she is? I never
Could
heard
be.
Of her.
I hadn't heard of her either. She
You're
has
not
a
old,
very
so.
Particular demographic, but I'm older than 26.
Okay. Colleen Hoover, she's
just by a month.
By a month, yeah.
By a month.
I like that story.
She's the number three.
She's the third highest followed author on Goodreads.
So I think that's not a hard name to remember.
They call her Coho. They have a nickname for her. She's Coho. That's what they call her.
Colleen Hoover. So if you just sort of Google that, you'll get all her titles.
You'll get all her titles. We have all the titles at the library.
And they're probably all quick picks. Or a lot
I
of them.
Think there might be a couple others that are quick picks, but they all have hold lists. So,
well, because the things you learn on this show, this is why the All Sides Weekend Books is such a great show.
I just want to commend everyone on the level of restraint of not making a joke out of the abbreviated
her nickname.
Yeah, I was going down the path of, is that a hashtag on Twitter? And then I thought, well, she's probably not on Twitter because of the demographics.
She's TikTok. But she's, I think, on all social media platforms.
You don't
I
mean a clock
on Twitter.
When you say TikTok,
no, TikTok
right?
Is
no,
a,
I mean like
TikTok
the
is a social
I know
media
what it is.
Thing. Okay,
I'm not that far gone, for God's sake. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. And I don't know about you, but I need a break, y'all. So we're going to take a break for a minute and come right back with more. Don't go away. Fasten your seatbelts. We are back for more of All Sides Weekend Books with Chris Hickey from the Columbus Metropolitan Library, who brings us quick picks, with Nick White from The Ohio State University, and thank God with Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. Cassie Rose, you brought us Claire Keegan last time, and now everybody's trying to recover from the beauty of that book and that writing. Thank you for that. What do you have for us today?
I'm going to recommend a book that came out this month by Antoine Wilson. I think it's his third novel, and it's called Mouth to Mouth. And I will say it is a page-turner. It's a subtle page-turner because of the themes of deception and manipulation that are going on. A man comes to the airport to get his flight to Frankfurt. It's JFK. It's delayed, and he has a chance encounter with a man named Jeff Cook, who he knew at UCLA 20 years before. Jeff Cook has done very well in his life, and he suggests they go to the first class lounge and wait out their delayed flight because he's on the same flight to Frankfurt. He also begins to tell a story to this narrator, that a story he's never told anyone before. And he says, because this narrator is the one person that, well, he says it was serendipitous. We ran into each other because you knew me before. And what we as readers come to realize that, well, we knew him. He knew him when the guy had a good heart. Mm. So there's a little bit of setup of tension that's there. And the story he tells is that he saved a drowning man just out of college. And he then becomes obsessed with finding out or having the man recognize him. Now, he doesn't use that word obsessed. He doesn't in any way say that. He portrays himself as a young man who innocently was traumatized, actually, by saving the life of this man who was drowning off of an ocean beach, found out that he was an art gallery dealer and owner and very prominent in Beverly Hills. So he concocts a run-in on the sidewalks with him, and the man doesn't recognize him, and that bothers him. So then he takes a job at the art gallery because there's a job opening, and he does get it. So long story short, he gets involved in the man's gallery and in his family life. He dates the daughter. And all along as he's narrating the story or telling the story to the narrator in the first person, in the first class lounge, in that present part of it, you know, the narrator will ask him questions like, well, why? Why didn't you tell anyone this story before? Or why this or that? And we begin to sense this, something's a little off. And Jeff Cook just says, well, stick with me. Because the story feels innocent. It gets to the point where he can't really reveal himself that he's saved a life. And so then he says that he wants to figure out, what does it mean to save a life? How did it affect this man? Well, I'm going to tell you that the tension in this just gradually builds because you know this feels like an innocent story, but it's not. You see deception and manipulation going on in the past of 20 years ago, and you feel it in the present with this narrator. And when you get to that last page, it's surprising, it's startling, and it's brilliant, actually. It's masterfully written, and the way that this author engages you on both levels of the story, how he takes you in and out of the present and the past. I highly recommend it if you're looking for a book to just grab you, engage you, and completely surprise you at the end.
Mouth to Mouth by Antoine Wilson. Is he a writer you knew before?
I did not know him before, but he has written two books. I think one was called The Interlopers, and the other one was called, and there was 10 years in between, and one is called Panama City and the other The Interloper. And when I looked it up, it was interesting because I saw that there were about 10 years in between, which to me means something in that he's like Donna Tartt was the same with The Secret History, her first book, and then later. Not rushing to get another book out, but someone who is a long writer, takes the time and doesn't let their publicist or their agent push them into, you know, now we're on, you know, a high point, let's get another book out. That's what I hear in that kind of data about a writer, I would say.
The writer David Goodison the other night on a webinar was talking about that. His best-known work is Snow Falling on Cedars, mm-hmm. which was later made into a film. His new novel is called The Final Case, which I mm-hmm. warmly recommend, although it has some tragic and sad overtones. Mm-hmm. But he was saying that you know, he's, I think in a 35-year career, he's got 5 or 6 titles published. Mm-hmm. He says, when I'm ready, I'm ready. When I'm done, I'm mm-hmm. done. I mean, I'm not, you know, writing to schedule. And you and I, Cassie Rose, have interviewed writers that do 4 or 5 books a year. Remember that?
Yes.
Very successful
yes.
writers.
Wow.
Yes. But
yes.
So everybody's different, you know. Yeah.
And there are the ones that, and I think especially in the literary novel arena, they do need to take the time with the novels. I mean, this book is only about 200 pages, and it's so tautly written, and that it's brilliant. I mean, the Claire Keegan was, you know, very small too. And you don't have any sense in this book that, well, that was the past and this is the present. I mean, it is just fluid the way that you feel this moment that you're in the airport and the two of them are talking. And then it's back into the art gallery and maybe with the collectors and the dealers. And you see this or hear this comment that is made by the man that he saved, or you see something that Jeff Cook did, and you get a sense of something's not right here, or do I trust this? And then you're back again at the airport. You feel like you are sitting right beside the narrator who is listening to this story, and again thinking, why are you telling me this story? Why are you telling me this story now?
That kind of craft is hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I love these type of stories that are sort of like Russian doll stories, stories within stories. I love that. And that's such a hard thing to pull off because you have to constantly anticipate reader attention.
Yes, it is very hard to pull off, and that's a perfect way to put it, that Russian doll sense about it. And it is hard to pull off, and that's what he does so well, because you do not feel that, you don't feel the technique. You don't get a sense of, oh, this is a story within a story or anything. You are right there in that first class lounge listening while the guys are drinking.
Love it.
And then you go back, and because the whole time the question is this man, Jeff Cook, as an adult in front of you, and then who he was 20 years ago.
And not every writer can do that, give you the sense of immediacy. Mm-hmm. Nick White, you and Chris Hickey both have brought the same big, thick book, but you go ahead and speak about what you want to speak about next.
Well, the next book I want to talk about, Cassie Rose talked about it. 200-pager. I talked about Claire Keegan. I'm going to talk about a book that tops out at 800 pages.
Good
and I'm going to try
you.
To.
Right.
I'm going to try to encapsulate it as succinctly as possible. This is The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Jeffers. This book was published last year. It was actually on Oprah's book club pick. It is. It deals with, as the title suggests, this notion of W.E.B. Du Bois's theory that he sort of coined double consciousness, which is a concept in social philosophy referring to a sort of inward two-ness experienced by many African Americans at the time and when he was writing The Souls of Black Folks. But this is a novel about a character. I think you pronounce her name Ailey, A-I-L-E-Y. Who spends her summer, she lives in the North, but she spends her summers in Georgia. And as the title suggests, it talks about her experiencing this double consciousness, in addition to being like Black in America, but also being a woman and her experiences in education, starting out going to a predominantly Black school, then a predominantly white school, then eventually an HBCU, which her family has deep roots to. But interspersed in this story are the sections, because her story, Ailey's story, is told through the first person singular, narrated by her. Interspersed in the story are sections that Jeffers calls songs, which is told in the first person plural. And you learn about Ailey's ancestry through those sections. Mm. And each section are, and through those sections, they sort of echo together and speak to each other in really, really interesting ways. I read a review of this book in the New York Times, and I want to quote it because I think it summarizes this book nicely for those of you who are interested. It's by Veronica Chambers, and she says that this book is about Ailey's quest is this: how does a young Black woman craft a life that is joyful and whole against the backdrop of the American South, where the land is a minefield of treasures and tragedy? Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book. It's 800 pages, but it does not feel like 800 pages. I was telling Cassie Rose this. This is a perfect example of when language and story meet to create something that you just experience and move your way through. And if you're going to read one 800-page book this year, this is the one to do it.
It's been all over the awards. It certainly was part of the National Book Awards. It was a finalist. It's a finalist now for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And as you and I were talking, Nick, that it likely will be a candidate for the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a candidate for the Pulitzer. I also think, you know, this is a debut book by Jeffers.
It's her first book.
It's her first novel, mm-hmm. but she has five collections of poetry before mm-hmm. this. Uh-huh. And you can really tell that, I mean, the attention to language is masterful.
She loves words.
She loves words, and it's not done in a way. When I say that, it's not language where when you read it, it feels like you're reading writing. It's the reading that it goes directly into your soul, basically, and you're experiencing the story. You don't feel like you're reading writing. You feel like someone is sitting down telling you a story, and it didn't feel like 800 pages to me.
You know, that's a good reason why probably, like, coming here was that you and I were talking about how she wrote The Age of Phyllis, and I was thinking it was a book, and you were saying, well, no, it's a collection of poetry, and I was like, well, no, it's not. And then we were looking at it, like, you were right, and I thought, well, of course, because, and I didn't, it's the story that stayed with me. It's the words that stayed with me. I didn't categorize it as prose or a collection of poetry. And she does work with the word so well because that was the story of Phyllis Wheatley.
Phyllis Wheatley, right.
Phyllis Wheatley, who lived in Revolutionary War Boston, yes.
Yes,
right, of course.
So
yes.
She tells the story in a collection of poetry.
And I think that book won the National Book Award for poetry, right? I need to double check that, but I think it did, The Age of Phyllis.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
The name of the book is?
The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Jeffers. Definitely read this book. Check it out. Don't let the page count scare you away. This is a story that you're going to live through, and it's going to stay with you.
Well, that said, that an 800-page book, that's going to be a wonderful investment, then. That's terrific. Thank you for that recommendation. We're going to go to Quick Picks with Chris Hickey right now in the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Library. Let me remind everybody, you're listening to All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose, Nick White, and take it, Chris Hickey.
Okay, so this is a book that's getting a lot of buzz. It's called Olga Dies Dreaming by Xochil Gonzalez. And this is, it's a book, it's already been optioned by Hulu to be a series. So they're working on a pilot, which is going to star Aubrey Plaza, who was an actress who was on Parks and Rec. She played the deadpan character, she was so funny. So this is about a Puerto Rican family living in Brooklyn. And it's about a woman named Olga and her brother, Pietro. And when they were young, their mother left them to become a revolutionary to fight for Puerto Rican independence. Mm. And so she's, even though she's off stage much of this book, she's looming large in their lives. She communicates to them with letters throughout different points of their lives, mostly talking about how she's disappointed in their life choices. But Olga is
being a mother. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So Pietro is a very popular congressman in their district. And Olga, at the time we meet her, is a wedding planner for the rich in New York. Boy. And so the first chapter is about napkins and what kinds of napkins you will find at the most, you know, the highest dollar count weddings. Would you like to know the difference between a cheap napkin and an expensive one?
I would.
Please do.
Okay,
tell
so
us.
You know, this is when you know you're at a very wealthy person's wedding. So she said it for the less expensive napkins, the liquid will roll off and splatter on the floor, splatter in your clothes. If you are at the height of society, you will have linen napkins. And the linen will soak up the liquid and protect your couture.
Wait, I'm writing this down. Okay.
So this is, and you, check.
Well, where I grew up, we had paper napkins at our wedding.
Yes, I've never been to one of those.
But anyway, go back to the book, Olga Dies Dreaming.
Yes, so Olga Dies Dreaming. So she's a wedding planner, and so, she skims off the top now and again. Okay, she skims off the top a lot. So she collects these linen napkins that she's going to use for her cousin's wedding. And it sounds like it's a nice thing, right? But she's doing it to kind of show up her cousin, because then the family will be like, oh, Olga, you're so elegant. You made these napkins happen. So she's doing it to kind of stick it to her cousin a little bit. But it's about their family. And she's very unlucky in love. She's having an affair with one of the dads whose daughter's wedding she planned. And then she meets this man named Mateo. And, they hook up. He confesses he's a bit of a hoarder. But she has this connection to him. And so, you know, they start this really interesting relationship. And at the same time, her brother is being blackmailed by, I think the inspiration for these characters is probably the Koch brothers, So he's being he is a gay man who does not live openly. And so they've said, we have pictures of you. And so he makes all these decisions that are not good for the neighborhood because he's being blackmailed. So they're both of these characters are just fantastic. And
It sounds like a TV series. It sounds like a TV series. Olga Dies Dreaming.
Olga Dies Dreaming by Xochitl Gonzalez.
Sounds very episodic, the way you're describing it, like almost a novel in stories.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And that would lend itself to being a good TV series.
I think it'll be very entertaining.
And what is Anthem?
Oh, Anthem. So this is the new Josh Hawley book.
It's pretty hot. I'm seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. I'm seeing it everywhere, too. That's why I
It's been called one of the most, advantageous books of coming out in 2020. So it's about a group of kids who have great anxiety about the way the world is. So they want to go out and fix it. They want to go out and fix the problems that they're seeing. And so Josh Hawley decided to write it from a child's perspective because, you know, big things, adults will say, well, that's just very complicated, where a child will look at it and say, it's really not that complicated at all. And he was inspired by Greta Thunberg's address to the UN, where, you know, people are saying climate change is so complicated. And she says, it's really not complicated at all. And so he wanted to tell that story from that perspective. So this group of three children, they go out west where there's lots of wildfires and there's lots of terrorism, and they want to rescue a friend from this man known as the Wizard. And this man, this character, is based off of Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, yeah.
So it's got that factor in it. But I've got to share this quote because I listened to an interview and he said, this is, depending on your worldview, this is either a fantasy novel about the real world or a realistic novel about the fantasy world we live in.
And that's Noah Hawley.
Noah Hawley.
No,
did
Josh
I say Josh?
Hawley's a senator.
Yes, okay, yes. This is Noah Hawley. I'm so sorry.
Our producer, Bobby, God bless him, called
thank
us on
you.
That.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that. It's Noah Hawley. It's called Anthem.
It's called Anthem.
And it is a quick pick
it
at the Columbus
Library. It just came out.
Quick picks, by the way, come out on every Tuesday. Is that
yes,
right?
They
sounds
come
like
out every
Josh
Tuesday.
Hawley should read that, though.
Maybe. Yeah.
We'll go there later. Right now, we're going to take a break and come back with the last segment of All Sides Weekend Books Don't Go Away. Sometimes I wish this show was 2 or 3 hours from we all get together because we kind of forget the time and just go nuts and enjoy ourselves so much. And hopefully the listeners do as well. This is All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Christopher Purdy with Nick White from the Department of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University, with Chris Hickey, who was from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library, and Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic with The Pages.
By Hugo Hamilton, a novel that is coming out in February. A really interesting book because another interesting narrator. This time it's a book. So we have a book that is narrating a book, which sounds weird, but he pulls it off. And the book that is narrating the pages is Joseph Roth's Rebellion. Joseph Roth, which is a real book. So I will just, in the very beginning, a woman named Lena has a copy of this book in her travel bag. She is going to Berlin to find out the reason of the map that is drawn, hand-drawn, in the back of the book. She gets to Berlin and is having it at a cafe, and with a friend, a thief comes, grabs the bag, takes the passport, the wallet, dumps the bag and the book in the park, and so someone else then picks up this book that is our narrator. What we get in this book are two stories. One is that present story about that happens with Lena in the book, and she also goes to find her relatives, but also the history of this book that survived the 1933 book burning in Berlin. So it tells its own story of how it survived it, how the professor gave it to Lena's great-grandfather, or grandfather, and then father, and then the father gave it to her. He tells about the history of that. He writes, he tells about his creator, Joseph Roth. A lot of people know that author's name. He was writing in the 1920s. He was a prolific journalist, friend of Stefan Zweig, who became, they were both Austrian and became exiles, Jewish exiles during the Third Reich. So there's two very different stories going on. The one with Lena and the book, the man who finds the book, she does have a relationship with him, gets to know his sister, who is an up-and-coming pop star, and there is a man threatening and stalking her who is a right-wing nationalist. So there's that very present story going on. And then there is this book, The Rebellion, who hears and sees a lot of what is going on and, again, talks about his past, its past, I suppose, talks about Joseph Roth. And one of the fun things, too, is where it talks about book culture. Like when she brings it into the house of her uncle where her father grew up, and so this book was in the library shelves, all the books that are still in the library start cheering because he's back. The book is back. And then there's another point where he talks about how, saying how we talk to each other. There's this long discussion about, you know, the love scenes, all the different kinds of romances that can happen. So that is very fun in this book, that reveal about how books talk to each other and there, what goes on that we have no idea that's going on in our libraries. It's a very, very involved book. It's very interesting. It's very different. I think it will definitely appeal to people who know Joseph Roth. And Joseph Roth does have a big fan following. So I would highly recommend it for them and for anyone who is very intrigued just about this premise of a book that is narrated by a book.
Would this be a good book to read alongside Joseph Roth's Rebellion if we've never read it?
I don't know how to answer that because I thought I was going to read Rebellion first and then read this. And I thought, no, I won't. But now that I have read it, I do want to read Rebellion because he talks about his story. So we do know what Rebellion is about. And so certainly there are parallels that happen with the other stories that are going on here. So that's a long way of saying I'm not sure. But I'm certainly very curious about Joseph Roth, but I have been for a long time because I want to read the Radetzky March, which is one of his most famously known books, I believe. And I also have another book that has come out from Notting Hill, which is a very interesting press that publishes out of England. You can get the books here. And it has to do with an author who follows the path of Joseph Roth through Austria and Germany, trying to get to know him. Mm-hmm. It's called Wandering Jew. And I want to read that too. So there's a curiosity that comes, I think, about Joseph Roth from reading this.
So it's The Pages by Hugo Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
One book talks to another only on 89.7 NPR News, All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose, Nick White, and Chris Hickey. And Nick White and Chris Hickey brought the same book, each of them, which is a quick pick because I've seen it at Whetstone. So, Chris, do you want to help set up? And then
Because Nick has read the book. So
yes,
I'll just set up my way through it.
Okay.
Why it's become a quick pick. So this book is called To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. And she wrote the book A Little Life, which came out in 2015. It was on the list for the
Booker. It was shortlisted for the National Book Award. Many people predicted it to win the Pulitzer that year. It did not. It also is sort of seminal in gay literature. Mm-hmm. In the Atlantic did this wonderful essay about this book that had become viral called It Was the First Great Gay Book of Ideas. It's a book that looms large in literature, recent literature, but also gay literature as well.
And it took off on TikTok as well. I promise this is the last time I'm going to mention TikTok today. I'm sorry. Book influencers gravitated towards A Little Life and propelled it even, to other people who may not have found it before. And so it made her popular again.
So talk about the book.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. So I will say that I've read A Little Life as well, and I found that both books deal with trauma, but in different ways. A Little Life, I had to put that book down and come back to it. It took me like almost a year to read that book, and it was also long, like this one too. I think this one might be topped out. This one was easier for me to get through because it's constantly changing what type of book it is every 200 pages. It's basically To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara is basically three books in one, and I want to try to explain this as succinctly as possible. The first section takes place in 1893 in an alternate version of America. They have a map of the continent, and where there's several different sections of countries. America has been divided up after what's been called in the book the War of the Rebellion, where you have the free states, which includes places like New York and Massachusetts, the colonies, which is basically the South. You have the American Union, which is the Midwest, and then you have the Western Union, which is California, Washington, and Oregon. And this takes place in the free states in Washington Square in New York City. And what this is, the free states, it's where queer people can live openly and have marriages and families, and in 1893. And the first section is entitled Washington Square. And it is, to my mind, a queer, or in some cases, who you listen to, a queerer retelling of Washington Square by Henry James. And that's one of my favorite Henry James books. It's also made into one of my favorite movies, The Heiress by Olivia de Havilland. Anyway, this is sort of takes place a young man. He is from a wealthy family in Washington Square. His family wants him to marry this older gentleman from Massachusetts, I believe, because he comes from a new moneyed family, and his family can give his family some esteem. They can give their family. So it's like a great sort of match. The problem is he teaches the protagonist. He teaches at this school for orphans, and he teaches art. And the music teacher who teaches before him is this like entrancing man who he finds himself deeply attracted to. Problem is, he is a refugee from the colonies, where being gay is outlawed. And there's this question set where the protagonist is being pressured by his family to marry this older gentleman and not this younger man, because they believe the younger man is after him for his money and his name and his esteem. And as you begin reading, it's sort of in the same way that Washington Square leaves that ambiguous, that it's sort of ambiguous there as well. Fast forward 100 years later, 1993, a young Hawaiian man who is with an older gentleman had a relationship with him, and them dealing with the AIDS crisis in this alternate universe.
We're still in an alternative
sort of universe. And then we fast forward even further to, I believe it is, yes, 2093, where it is this totalitarian state. The planet is dying. This young woman is trying to figure out the secrets of find her missing husband and the secrets of her father. The things that this book does well, this is one of the most ambitious books I've ever read. And the things it does well is it takes this theme of hidden lives, secrets, loneliness, living lives that are fulfilling but maybe illegal, and what is the cost of that? These are constantly being echoed through the pages of the book. And I found it riveting. I found it a great big book of ideas, just like A Little Life was. It was unlike anything I have read in a long time. It was just with A Little Life, and just to forewarn readers, it is a challenging book. It is a very challenging
book. It sounds to me like a demanding book in a good way. I'm not trying to tell you that's because I don't want you to read it, because I want to read it now, having listened to the two of you talk about it. But very often for fiction, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris Hickey, but a quick pick tends to be less demanding, unless I'm...
I think that's a fair...
And this is a quick pick.
Yes, and this is a quick pick because of the popularity. the expected popularity due
is,
to
is
a
it
little
called
life.
In Paradise?
To Paradise.
To Paradise.
And
to
I will say
paradise.
this book is divided critics. Mm. It's been very divisive. And I think, you know, that's a sign that it's an interesting book you should check out.
Yeah, I mean, if they're talking about it, even if it's not all positive, they're talking about it. That is a great indicator.
What interested when I haven't read the book, but when I read about it, what interested me is that it made me think of not in terms of plot, but of Cloud Cuckoo Land because of the way that it is structured in the past, in the present, in the far future.
Yeah.
And that's what Anthony Doerr did with his.
I loved it. Cloud Cuckoo Land, I thought it was wonderful.
And I thought, well, the authors are looking to explore something, to figure something out with the idea that they're working with. And I don't think that it just struck me because these books are coming out so close to each other.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something going on with that. There's something going on.
I think
there's, it has to do, I think, some of this with the anxiety that not only artists, but all of us are feeling towards the future and what that may hold.
Mm-hmm. Because there was another book that I was reading about, a forecast, and it had the same kind of structure. So I thought there's a trend going on. And I think, the authors are trying to work something out.
To Paradise.
To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara.
Which is a quick pick at the Columbus Library. And get there on Tuesday mornings when the library opens. And every branch has the same display of Quick Picks.
Yes,
is that correct?
Every branch has a display of Quick Picks, and we all get the same titles.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I want Cassie Rose has brought a book by Elizabeth Taylor, not the actress. So I wonder, because that has become part of the conversation now. That's being written up again after a number of years.
Yes, this book called Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, Elizabeth Taylor, the other Elizabeth Taylor. That's what her biography is.
She's the first Elizabeth Taylor, really.
Yes. And I think her first book came out right around the time that the actress Elizabeth Taylor was in National Velvet.
Wow.
It was just unfortunate. But this book, Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, was, I think, her last book, and it is one of the most popular. And I will tell you, I love it. I'm within about 50 pages of the end. Just a charming, heartwarming, but also a little sad, but also lighthearted. I mean, it's just brilliant the way that she emotionally creates this character of Mrs. Palfrey, who lives at the Claremont Hotel in her retirement. It's kind of like, what was that, the Marigold, the best exotic Marigold hotel?
Yeah.
Well, it's not apples to apples there. But anyway, she goes to the Claremont. There's some quirky characters there. But one of the things is that she has a grandson who works at the British Museum. This is in London. And he doesn't come to see her. So one day she's taking a walk, she falls, and a young man from a basement apartment sees this, runs out, and helps her. And I'll say that he becomes the stand-in at the Claremont for the grandson because everybody's wondering about it. The one thing I want to say is that when he comes and helps her up, he doesn't just lean over her and just help her up. He picks her up and he hugs her. He pulls her to him. And the way that Elizabeth Taylor writes that is so moving that you will never forget it. And that is the kind of writing that is going on here.
Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont Hotel.
By Elizabeth Taylor.
By Elizabeth Taylor, published probably in the early 1940s and dating National Velvet, which is the other Elizabeth
Taylor. This was her last book, so 1960s.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend Books. I could stay here for four more hours, but they're not going to let us do that. We may do that anyway because we tend to do that more off mic. I want to thank Chris Hickey from the Columbus Metropolitan Library who brought us all the Quick Picks. Thank you, Chris Hickey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick White. Glad to have you back with us from the Department of English and Creative Writing, professor at The Ohio State University. Thank you, Cassie Rose. Your blog is thelongestchapter.com. Thank you to senior producer Marcus Charlton. Thank you to assistant producer Bobby Gerbic. Thank you to the interns, Lucy Shepherd, Emma Bowers, and Coco Knutzman, with video production by The Ohio Channel. Our board operation, who sends us all the good information, is Bobby Gerbic. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director is Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrella. Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. I'm Christopher Purdy.